This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Noise, A Flaw in Human Judgment by Daniel Kahneman, Olivier Sibonyi, and Cass R. Sunstein. Read for you by Jonathan Todd Ross. This program includes a downloadable PDF with figures from the book. Introduction. Two kinds of error. Imagine that four teams of friends have gone to a shooting arcade. Each team consists of five people. They share one rifle, and each person fires one shot. Team A's shots are all close to the bullseye. Team B's shots are all in the same vicinity but are not near the bullseye. Team C's shots are spread out, and Team D's shots are both spread out and inaccurate. For a visual representation of this, see Figure 1 on the attached PDF. In an ideal world, every shot would hit the bullseye. That is nearly the case for Team A. The team's shots are tightly clustered around the bullseye, close to a perfect pattern. We call Team B biased because its shots are systematically off target. The consistency of the bias supports a prediction. If one of the team members were to take another shot, we would bet on its landing in the same area as the first five. The consistency of the bias also invites a causal explanation. Perhaps the gun sight on the team's rifle was bent. We call Team C noisy because its shots are widely scattered. There is no obvious bias because the impacts are roughly centered on the bullseye. If one of the team members took another shot, we would know very little about where it is likely to hit. Furthermore, no interesting hypothesis comes to mind to explain the results of Team C. We know that its members are poor shots. We do not know why they are so noisy. Team D is both biased and noisy. Like Team B, its shots are systematically off target. Like Team C, its shots are widely scattered. But this is not a book about target shooting. Our topic is human error. Bias and noise, systematic deviation and random scatter are different components of error. The targets illustrate the difference. The shooting range is a metaphor for what can go wrong in human judgment, especially in the diverse decisions that people make on behalf of organizations. In these situations, we will find the two types of error illustrated by the shots. Some judgments are biased. They are systematically off target. Other judgments are noisy, as people who are expected to agree end up at very different points around the target. Many organizations, unfortunately, are afflicted by both bias and noise. Figure 2, which can also be found on the bonus PDF, illustrates an important difference between bias and noise. It shows what you would see at the shooting range if you were shown only the backs of the targets at which the teams were shooting, without any indication of the bullseye they were aiming at. From the back of the target, you cannot tell whether Team A or Team B is closer to the bullseye. But you can tell at a glance that Teams C and D are noisy, and that Teams A and B are not. Indeed, you know just as much about scatter as you did in Figure 1. A general property of noise is that you can recognize and measure it while knowing nothing about the target or bias. The general property of noise just mentioned is essential for our purposes in this book, because many of our conclusions are drawn from judgments whose true answer is unknown or even unknowable. When physicians offer different diagnoses for the same patient, we can study their disagreement without knowing what ails the patient. When film executives estimate the market for a movie, we can study the variability of their answers without knowing how much the film eventually made, or even if it was produced at all. We don't need to know who is right to measure how much the judgments of the same case vary. All we have to do to measure noise is look at the back of the target. To understand error in judgment, we must understand both bias and noise. Sometimes, as we will see, noise is the more important problem. But in public conversations about human error and in organizations all over the world, noise is rarely recognized. Bias is the star of the show. Noyes is a bit player, usually off stage. The topic of bias has been discussed in thousands of scientific articles and dozens of popular books, few of which even mention the issue of Noyes. This book is our attempt to redress the balance. In real-world decisions, the amount of Noyes is often scandalously high. Here are a few examples of the alarming amount of Noyes in situations in which accuracy matters. Medicine is noisy. Faced with the same patient, different doctors make different judgments about whether patients have skin cancer, breast cancer, heart disease, tuberculosis, pneumonia, depression, and a host of other conditions. Noyes is especially high in psychiatry, where subjective judgment is obviously important. However, considerable Noyes is also found in areas where it might not be expected, such as in the reading of x-rays. Child custody decisions are noisy. Case managers and child protection agencies must assess whether children are at risk of abuse and, if so, whether to place them in foster care. The system is noisy, given that some managers are much more likely than others to send a child to foster care. Years later, more of the unlucky children who have been assigned to foster care by these heavy-handed managers have poor life outcomes, higher delinquency rates, higher teen birth rates, and lower earnings. Forecasts are noisy. Professional forecasters offer highly variable predictions about likely sales of a new product, likely growth in the unemployment rate, the likelihood of bankruptcy for troubled companies, and just about everything else. Not only do they disagree with each other, but they also disagree with themselves. For example, when the same software developers were asked on two separate days to estimate the completion time for the same task, the hours they projected differed by 71% on average. Asylum decisions are noisy. Whether an asylum seeker will be admitted into the United States depends on something like a lottery. A study of cases that were randomly allotted to different judges found that one judge admitted 5% of applicants, while another admitted 88%. The title of the study says it all: Refugee Roulette. We are going to see a lot of roulette. Personnel decisions are noisy. Interviewers of job candidates make widely different assessments of the same people. Performance ratings of the same employees are also highly variable and depend more on the person doing the assessment than on the performance being assessed. Bail decisions are noisy. Whether an accused person will be granted bail or instead sent to jail pending trial depends partly on the identity of the judge who ends up hearing the case. Some judges are far more lenient than others. Judges also differ markedly in their assessment of which defendants present the highest risk of flight or reoffending. Forensic science is noisy. We have been trained to think of fingerprint identification as infallible, but fingerprint examiners sometimes differ in deciding whether a print found at a crime scene matches that of a suspect. Not only do experts disagree, but the same experts sometimes make inconsistent decisions when presented with the same print on different occasions. Similar variability has been documented in other forensic science disciplines, even DNA analysis. Decisions to grant patents are noisy. The authors of a leading study on patent applications emphasize the noise involved. Whether the patent office grants or rejects a patent is significantly related to the happenstance of which examiner is assigned the application. This variability is obviously troublesome from the standpoint of equity. All these noisy situations are the tip of a large iceberg. Wherever you look at human judgments, you are likely to find noise. To improve the quality of our judgments, we need to overcome noise as well as bias. This book comes in 6 parts. In part 1, we explore the difference between noise and bias, and we show that both public and private organizations can be noisy, sometimes shockingly so. To appreciate the problem, we begin with judgments in 2 areas. The first involves criminal sentencing, and hence the public sector. The second involves insurance, and hence the private sector. At first glance, the two areas could not be more different. But with respect to noise, they have much in common. To establish that point, we introduce the idea of a noise audit, designed to measure how much disagreement there is among professionals considering the same cases within an organization. In part two, we investigate the nature of human judgment and explore how to measure accuracy and error. Judgments are susceptible to both bias and noise. We describe a striking equivalence in the roles of the two types of error. Occasion noise is the variability in judgments of the same case by the same person or group on different occasions. A surprising amount of occasion noise arises in group discussion because of seemingly irrelevant factors, such as who speaks first. Part 3 takes a deeper look at one type of judgment that has been researched extensively, predictive judgment. We explore the key advantage of rules, formulas, and algorithms over humans when it comes to making predictions. Contrary to popular belief, it is not so much the superior insight of rules, but their noiselessness. We discuss the ultimate limit on the quality of predictive judgment, objective ignorance of the future, and how it conspires with noise to limit the quality of prediction. Finally, we address a question that you will almost certainly have asked yourself by then. If noise is so ubiquitous, then why had you not noticed it before? Part 4 turns to human psychology. We explain the central causes of noise. These include interpersonal differences arising from a variety of factors, including personality and cognitive style, idiosyncratic variations in the weighting of different considerations, and the different uses that people make of the very same scales. We explore why people are oblivious to noise and are frequently unsurprised by events and judgments they could not possibly have predicted. Part 5 explores the practical question of how you can improve your judgments and prevent error. Readers who are primarily interested in practical applications of noise reduction might skip the discussion of the challenges of prediction and of the psychology of judgment in parts 3 and 4 and move directly to this part. We investigate efforts to tackle noise in medicine, business, education, government, and elsewhere. We introduce several noise reduction techniques that we collect under the label of decision hygiene. We present 5 case studies of domains in which there is much documented noise and in which people have made sustained efforts to reduce it, with instructively varying degrees of success. The case studies include unreliable medical diagnoses, performance ratings, forensic science, hiring decisions, and forecasting in general. We conclude by offering a system we call the Mediating Assessments Protocol, a general-purpose approach to the evaluation of options that incorporates several key practices of decision hygiene and aims to produce less noisy and more reliable judgments. What is the right level of noise? Part 6 turns to this question. Perhaps counterintuitively, the right level is not zero. In some areas, it just isn't feasible to eliminate noise. In other areas, it is too expensive to do so. In still other areas, efforts to reduce noise would compromise important competing values. For example, efforts to eliminate noise could undermine morale and give people a sense that they are being treated like cogs in a machine. When algorithms are part of the answer, they raise an assortment of objections. We address some of them here. Still, the current level of noise is unacceptable. We urge both private and public organizations to conduct noise audits and to undertake with unprecedented seriousness stronger efforts to reduce noise. Should they do so, organizations could reduce widespread unfairness and reduce costs in many areas. With that aspiration in mind, we end each chapter with a few brief propositions in the form of quotations. You can use these statements as they are, or adapt them for any issues that matter to you, whether they involve health, safety, education, money, employment, entertainment, or something else. Understanding the problem of noise and trying to solve it is a work in progress and a collective endeavor. All of us have opportunities to contribute to this work. This book is written in the hope that we can seize those opportunities. Part 1. Finding Noise. It is not acceptable for similar people convicted of the same offense to end up with dramatically different sentences, say 5 years in jail for one and probation for another. And yet, in many places, something like that happens. To be sure, the criminal justice system is pervaded by bias as well. But our focus in Chapter 1 is on noise, and in particular on what happened when a famous judge drew attention to it, found it scandalous, and launched a crusade that, in a sense, changed the world. But not enough. Our tale involves the United States, but we are confident that similar stories can be and will be told about many other nations. In some of those nations, the problem of noise is likely to be even worse than it is in the United States. We use the example of sentencing in part to show that noise can produce great unfairness. Criminal sentencing has especially high drama, but we are also concerned with the private sector, where the stakes can be large too. To illustrate the point, we turn in Chapter 2 to a large insurance company. There, underwriters have the task of setting insurance premiums for potential clients, and claims adjusters must judge the value of claims. You might predict that these tasks would be simple and mechanical, and that different professionals would come up with roughly the same amounts. We conducted a carefully designed experiment, a noise audit, to test that prediction. The results surprised us, but more importantly, they astonished and dismayed the company's leadership. As we learned, the sheer volume of noise is costing the company a great deal of money. We use this example to show that noise can produce large economic losses. Both of these examples involve studies of a large number of people making a large number of judgments. But many important judgments are singular rather than repeated. How to handle an apparently unique business opportunity. Whether to launch a whole new product, how to deal with a pandemic, whether to hire someone who just doesn't meet the standard profile. Can noise be found in decisions about unique situations like these? It is tempting to think that it is absent there. After all, noise is unwanted variability, and how can you have variability with singular decisions? In Chapter 3, we try to answer this question. The judgment that you make, even in a seemingly unique situation, is one in a cloud of possibilities. You will find a lot of noise there as well. The theme that emerges from these three chapters can be summarized in one sentence, which will be a key theme of this book. Wherever there is judgment, there is noise, and more of it than you think. Let's start to find out how much. Chapter 1. Crime and Noisy Punishment. Suppose that someone has been convicted of a crime, shoplifting, possession of heroin, assault, or armed robbery. What is the sentence likely to be? The answer should not depend on the particular judge to whom the case happens to be assigned, on whether it is hot or cold outside, or on whether a local sports team won the day before. It would be outrageous if three similar people convicted of the same crime received radically different penalties, probation for one, 2 years in jail for another, and 10 years in jail for another. And yet that outrage can be found in many nations, not only in the distant past, but also today. All over the world, judges have long had a great deal of discretion in deciding on appropriate sentences. In many nations, experts have celebrated this discretion and have seen it as both just and humane. They have insisted that criminal sentences should be based on a host of factors involving not only the crime, but also the defendant's character and circumstances. Individualized tailoring was the order of the day. If judges were constrained by rules, criminals would be treated in a dehumanized way. They would not be seen as unique individuals entitled to draw attention to the details of their situation. The very idea of due process of law seemed, to many, to call for open-ended judicial discretion. In the 1970s, the universal enthusiasm for judicial discretion started to collapse for one simple reason: startling evidence of noise. In 1973, a famous judge, Marvin Frankel, drew public attention to the problem. Before he became a judge, Frankel was a defender of freedom of speech and a passionate human rights advocate who helped found the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, an organization now known as Human Rights First. Frankel could be fierce, and with respect to noise in the criminal justice system, he was outraged. Here is how he describes his motivation. If a federal bank robbery defendant was convicted, he or she could receive a maximum of 25 years. That meant anything from 0 to 25 years. And where the number was set, I soon realized, depended less on the case or the individual defendant than on the individual judge, for example, on the views, predilections, and biases of the judge. So the same defendant in the same case could get widely different sentences depending on which judge got the case. Frankel did not provide any kind of statistical analysis to support his argument, but he did offer a series of powerful anecdotes showing unjustified disparities in the treatment of similar people. Two men, neither of whom had a criminal record, were convicted for cashing counterfeit checks in the amount of $58.40 and $35.20, respectively. The first man was sentenced to 15 years, the second to 30 days. For embezzlement actions that were similar to one another, one man was sentenced to 117 days in prison, while another was sentenced to 20 years. Pointing to numerous cases of this kind, Frankel deplored what he called the almost wholly unchecked and sweeping powers of federal judges, resulting in arbitrary cruelties perpetrated daily, which he deemed unacceptable in a government of laws, not of men. Frankel called on Congress to end this discrimination, as he described those arbitrary cruelties. By that term, he mainly meant noise, in the form of inexplicable variations in sentencing. But he was also concerned about bias, in the form of racial and socioeconomic disparities. To combat both noise and bias, he urged that differences in treatment of criminal defendants should not be allowed unless the differences could be justified by relevant tests capable of formulation and application with sufficient objectivity to ensure that the results will be more than the idiosyncratic ukases of particular officials, justices, or others. The term idiosyncratic ukases is a bit esoteric. By it, Frankel meant personal edicts. Much more than that, Frankel argued for a reduction in noise through a detailed profile or checklist of factors that would include, wherever possible, some form of numerical or other objective grading. Writing in the early 1970s, he did not go quite so far as to defend what he called displacement of people by machines. But startlingly, he came close. He believed that the rule of law calls for a body of impersonal rules, applicable across the board, binding on judges as well as everyone else. He explicitly argued for the use of computers as an aid toward orderly thought in sentencing. He also recommended the creation of a commission on sentencing. Frankel's book became one of the most influential in the entire history of criminal law, not only in the United States, but also throughout the world. His work did suffer from a degree of informality. It was devastating but impressionistic. To test for the reality of noise, several people immediately followed up by exploring the level of noise in criminal sentencing. An early large-scale study of this kind, chaired by Judge Frankel himself, took place in 1974. 50 judges from various districts were asked to set sentences for defendants in hypothetical cases summarized in identical pre-sentence reports. The basic finding was that absence of consensus was the norm, and that the variations across punishments were astounding. A heroin dealer could be incarcerated for 1 to 10 years, depending on the judge. Punishments for a bank robber ranged from 5 to 18 years in prison. The study found that in an extortion case, sentences varied from a whopping 20 years imprisonment and a $65,000 fine to a mere 3 years imprisonment and no fine. Most startling of all, in 16 of 20 cases, there was no unanimity on whether any incarceration was appropriate. This study was followed by a series of others, all of which found similarly shocking levels of noise. In 1977, for example, William Austin and Thomas Williams conducted a survey of 47 judges, asking them to respond to the same 5 cases, each involving low-level offenses. All the descriptions of the cases included summaries of the information used by judges in actual sentencing, such as the charge, the testimony, the previous criminal record, if any, social background, and evidence relating to character. The key finding was substantial disparity. In a case involving burglary, for example, the recommended sentences ranged from 5 years in prison to a mere 30 days, alongside a fine of $100. In a case involving possession of marijuana, some judges recommended prison terms. Others recommended probation. A much larger study conducted in 1981 involved 208 federal judges who were exposed to the same 16 hypothetical cases. Its central findings were stunning. In only 3 of the 16 cases was there a unanimous agreement to impose a prison term. Even where most judges agreed that a prison term was appropriate, there was a substantial variation in the lengths of prison terms recommended. In one fraud case in which the mean prison term was 8.5 years, the longest term was life in prison. In another case, the mean prison term was 1.1 years, yet the longest prison term recommended was 15 years. As revealing as they are, these studies, which involve tightly controlled experiments, almost certainly understate the magnitude of noise in the real world of criminal justice. Real-life judges are exposed to far more information than what the study participants received in the carefully specified vignettes of these experiments. Some of this additional information is relevant, of course, but there is also ample evidence that irrelevant information, in the form of small and seemingly random factors, can produce major differences in outcomes. For example, judges have been found more likely to grant parole at the beginning of the day or after a food break than immediately before such a break. If judges are hungry, they are tougher. A study of thousands of juvenile court decisions found that when the local football team loses a game on the weekend, the judges make harsher decisions on the Monday, and to a lesser extent, for the rest of the week. Black defendants disproportionately bear the brunt of that increased harshness. A different study looked at 1.5 million judicial decisions over 3 decades, and similarly found that judges are more severe on days that follow a loss by the local city's football team than they are on days that follow a win. A study of 6 million decisions made by judges in France over 12 years found that defendants are given more leniency on their birthday. The defendant's birthday, that is. We suspect that judges might be more lenient on their own birthdays as well, but as far as we know, that hypothesis has not been tested. Even something as irrelevant as outside temperature can influence judges. A review of 207,000 immigration court decisions over 4 years found a significant effect of daily temperature variations. When it is hot outside, people are less likely to get asylum. If you are suffering political persecution in your home country and want asylum elsewhere, you should hope and maybe even pray that your hearing falls on a cool day. Reducing noise in sentencing. In the 1970s, Frankel's arguments and the empirical findings supporting them came to the attention of Edward M. Kennedy, brother of the slain President John F. Kennedy, and one of the most influential members of the U.S. Senate. Kennedy was shocked and appalled. As early as 1975, he introduced sentencing reform legislation. It didn't go anywhere, but Kennedy was relentless. pointing to the evidence, he continued to press for the enactment of that legislation, year after year. In 1984, he succeeded. Responding to the evidence of unjustified variability, Congress enacted the Sentencing Reform Act of 1984. The new law was intended to reduce noise in the system by reducing the unfettered discretion the law confers on those judges and parole authorities responsible for imposing and implementing the sentences. In particular, members of Congress referred to unjustifiably wide sentencing disparity, specifically citing findings that in the New York area, punishments for identical actual cases could range from 3 years to 20 years of imprisonment. Just as Judge Frankel had recommended, the law created the U.S. Sentencing Commission, whose principal job was clear: to issue sentencing guidelines that were meant to be mandatory and that would establish a restricted range for criminal sentences. In the following year, the commission established those guidelines, which were generally based on average sentences for similar crimes in an analysis of 10,000 actual cases. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, who was heavily involved in the process, defended the use of past practice by pointing to the intractable disagreement within the commission. Why didn't the commission sit down and really go and rationalize this thing and not just take history? The short answer to that is, we couldn't. We couldn't because there are such good arguments all over the place pointing in opposite directions. Try listing all the crimes that there are in rank order of punishable merit. Then collect results from your friends and see if they all match. I will tell you they won't. Under the guidelines, judges have to consider two factors to establish sentences: the crime and the defendant's criminal history. Crimes are assigned one of 43 offense levels, depending on their seriousness. The defendant's criminal history refers principally to the number and severity of a defendant's previous convictions. Once the crime and the criminal history are put together, the guidelines offer a relatively narrow range of sentencing, with the top of the range authorized to exceed the bottom by the greater of 6 months or 25%. Judges are permitted to depart from the range altogether by reference to what they see as aggravating or mitigating circumstances, but departures must be justified to an appellate court. Even though the guidelines are mandatory, they are not entirely rigid. They do not go nearly as far as Judge Frankel wanted. They offer judges significant room to maneuver. Nonetheless, several studies using a variety of methods and focused on a range of historical periods reach the same conclusion: the guidelines cut the noise. More technically, they reduced the net variation in sentence attributable to the happenstance of the identity of the sentencing judge. The most elaborate study came from the commission itself. It compared sentences in bank robbery, cocaine distribution, heroin distribution, and bank embezzlement cases in 1985, before the guidelines went into effect, with the sentences imposed between January 19, 1989 and September 30, 1990. Offenders were matched with respect to the factors deemed relevant to sentencing under the guidelines. For every offense, variations across judges were much smaller in the later period, after the Sentencing Reform Act had been implemented. According to another study, the expected difference in sentence length between judges was 17%, or 4.9 months, in 1986 and 1987. That number fell to 11%, or 3.9 months, between 1988 and 1993. An independent study covering different periods found similar success in reducing interjudge disparities, which were defined as the differences in average sentences among judges with similar caseloads. Despite these findings, the guidelines ran into a firestorm of criticism. Some people, including many judges, thought that some sentences were too severe, a point about bias, not noise. For our purposes, a much more interesting objection, which came from numerous judges, was that guidelines were deeply unfair because they prohibited judges from taking adequate account of the particulars of the case. The price of reducing noise was to make decisions unacceptably mechanical. Yale law professor Kate Stith and federal judge Jose Cabranes wrote that the need is not for blindness, but for insight, for equity, which can only occur in a judgment that takes account of the complexities of the individual case. This objection led to vigorous challenges to the guidelines, some of them based on law, others based on policy. Those challenges failed until, for technical reasons entirely unrelated to the debate summarized here, the Supreme Court struck the guidelines down in 2005. As a result of the court's ruling, the guidelines became merely advisory. Notably, most federal judges were much happier after the Supreme Court decision. 75% preferred the advisory regime, whereas just 3% thought the mandatory regime was better. What have been the effects of changing the guidelines from mandatory to advisory? Harvard Law professor Crystal Yang investigated this question, not with an experiment or a survey, but with a massive data set of actual sentences, involving nearly 400,000 criminal defendants. Her central finding is that, by multiple measures, inter-judge disparities increased significantly after 2005. When the guidelines were mandatory, defendants who had been sentenced by a relatively harsh judge were sentenced to 2.8 months longer than if they had been sentenced by an average judge. When the guidelines became merely advisory, the disparity was doubled. Sounding much like Judge Frankel from 40 years before, Yang writes that her findings raise large equity concerns because the identity of the assigned sentencing judge contributes significantly to the disparate treatment of similar offenders convicted of similar crimes. After the guidelines became advisory, judges became more likely to base their sentencing decisions on their personal values. Mandatory guidelines reduce bias as well as noise. After the Supreme Court's decision, there was a significant increase in the disparity between the sentences of African-American defendants and white people convicted of the same crimes. At the same time, female judges became more likely than male judges were to exercise their increased discretion in favor of leniency. The same is true of judges appointed by Democratic presidents. 3 years after Frankel's death in 2002, striking down the mandatory guidelines produced a return to something more like his nightmare: law without order. The story of Judge Frankel's fight for sentencing guidelines offers a glimpse of several of the key points we will cover in this book. First, judgment is difficult because the world is a complicated, uncertain place. This complexity is obvious in the judiciary and holds in most other situations requiring professional judgment. Broadly, these situations include judgments made by doctors, nurses, lawyers, engineers, teachers, architects, Hollywood executives, members of hiring committees, book publishers, corporate executives of all kinds, and managers of sports teams. Disagreement is unavoidable wherever judgment is involved. Second, the extent of these disagreements is much greater than we expect. While few people object to the principle of judicial discretion, almost everyone disapproves of the magnitude of the disparities it produces. System noise, that is, unwanted variability in judgments that should ideally be identical, can create rampant injustice, high economic costs, and errors of many kinds. Third, noise can be reduced. The approach advocated by Frankel and implemented by the U.S. Sentencing Commission, Rules and Guidelines, is one of several approaches that successfully reduce noise. Other approaches are better suited to other types of judgment. Some methods adopted to reduce noise can simultaneously reduce bias as well. Fourth, efforts at noise reduction often raise objections and run into serious difficulties. These issues must be addressed too, or the fight against noise will fail. Speaking of noise in sentencing, experiments show large disparities among judges in the sentences they recommend for identical cases. This variability cannot be fair. A defendant's sentence should not depend on which judge the case happens to be assigned to. Criminal sentences should not depend on the judge's mood during the hearing or on the outside temperature. Guidelines are one way to address this issue. But many people don't like them because they limit judicial discretion, which might be necessary to ensure fairness and accuracy. After all, each case is unique, isn't it? Chapter 2. A Noisy System. Our initial encounter with noise, and what first triggered our interest in the topic, was not nearly so dramatic as a brush with the criminal justice system. Actually, the encounter was a kind of accident, involving an insurance company that had engaged the consulting firm with which two of us were affiliated. Of course, the topic of insurance is not everyone's cup of tea. But our findings showed the magnitude of the problem of noise in a for-profit organization that stands to lose a lot from noisy decisions. Our experience with the insurance company helps explain why the problem is so often unseen and what might be done about it. The insurance company's executives were weighing the potential value of an effort to increase consistency, to reduce noise, in the judgments of people who made significant financial decisions on the firm's behalf. Everyone agreed that consistency is desirable. Everyone also agreed that these judgments could never be entirely consistent because they are informal and partly subjective. Some noise is inevitable. Disagreement emerged when it came to its magnitude. The executives doubted that noise could be a substantial problem for their company. Much to their credit, however, they agreed to settle the question by a kind of simple experiment that we will call a noise audit. The result surprised them. It also turned out to be a perfect illustration of the problem of noise. A lottery that creates noise. Many professionals in any large company are authorized to make judgments that bind the company. For example, this insurance company employs numerous underwriters who quote premiums for financial risks, such as insuring a bank against losses due to fraud or rogue trading. It also employs many claims adjusters who forecast the cost of future claims, and also negotiate with claimants if disputes arise. Every large branch of the company has several qualified underwriters. When a quote is requested, anyone who happens to be available may be assigned to prepare it. In effect, the particular underwriter who will determine a quote is selected by a lottery. The exact value of the quote has significant consequences for the company. A high premium is advantageous if the quote is accepted, but such a premium risks losing the business to a competitor. A low premium is more likely to be accepted, but it is less advantageous to the company. For any risk, there is a Goldilocks price that is just right, neither too high nor too low. And there is a good chance that the average judgment of a large group of professionals is not too far from this Goldilocks number. Prices that are higher or lower than this number are costly. This is how the variability of noisy judgments hurts the bottom line. The job of claims adjusters also affects the finances of the company. For example, suppose that a claim is submitted on behalf of a worker, the claimant, who permanently lost the use of his right hand in an industrial accident. An adjuster is assigned to the claim, just as the underwriter was assigned, because she happens to be available. The adjuster gathers the facts of the case and provides an estimate of its ultimate cost to the company. The same adjuster then takes charge of negotiating with the claimant's representative to ensure that the claimant receives the benefits promised in the policy, while also protecting the company from making excessive payments. The early estimate matters, because it sets an implicit goal for the adjuster in future negotiations with the claimant. The insurance company is also legally obligated to reserve the predicted cost of each claim, for example, to have enough cash to be able to pay it. Here again, there is a Goldilocks value from the perspective of the company. A settlement is not guaranteed, as there is an attorney for the claimant on the other side who may choose to go to court if the offer is miserly. On the other hand, an overly generous reserve may allow the adjuster too much latitude to agree to frivolous demands. The adjuster's judgment is consequential for the company, and even more consequential for the claimant. We use the word lottery to emphasize the role of chance in the selection of one underwriter or adjuster. In the normal operation of the company, a single professional is assigned to a case, and no one can ever know what would have happened if another colleague had been selected instead. Lotteries have their place, and they need not be unjust. Acceptable lotteries are used to allocate goods, like courses in some universities, or bads, like the draft in the military. They serve a purpose. But the judgment lotteries we talk about allocate nothing. They just produce uncertainty. Imagine an insurance company whose underwriters are noiseless and set the optimal premium, but a chance device then intervenes to modify the quote that the client actually sees. Evidently, there would be no justification for such a lottery. Neither is there any justification for a system in which the outcome depends on the identity of the person randomly chosen to make a professional judgment. Noise audits reveal system noise. The lottery that picks a particular judge to establish a criminal sentence, or a single shooter to represent a team, creates variability. But this variability remains unseen. A noise audit like the one conducted on federal judges with respect to sentencing is a way to reveal noise. In such an audit, the same case is evaluated by many individuals, and the variability of their responses is made visible. The judgments of underwriters and claims adjusters lend themselves especially well to this exercise because their decisions are based on written information. To prepare for the noise audit, executives of the company constructed detailed descriptions of 5 representative cases for each group, underwriters and adjusters. Employees were asked to evaluate 2 or 3 cases each, working independently. They were not told that the purpose of the study was to examine the variability of their judgments. Before listening on, you may want to think of your own answer to the following questions. In a well-run insurance company, if you randomly selected 2 qualified underwriters or claims adjusters, how different would you expect their estimates for the same case to be? Specifically, what would be the difference between the 2 estimates as a percentage of their average? We asked numerous executives in the company for their answers, and in subsequent years, we have obtained estimates from a wide variety of people in different professions. Surprisingly, one answer is clearly more popular than all others. Most executives of the insurance company guessed 10% or less. When we asked 828 CEOs and senior executives from a variety of industries how much variation they expected to find in similar expert judgments, 10% was also the median answer, and the most frequent one. The second most popular was 15%. A 10% difference would mean, for instance, that one of the 2 underwriters set a premium of $9,500, while the other quoted $10,500. Not a negligible difference, but one that an organization can be expected to tolerate. Our noise audit found much greater differences. By our measure, the median difference in underwriting was 55%. About 5 times as large as was expected by most people, including the company's executives. This result means, for instance, that when one underwriter sets a premium of $9,500, the other does not set it at $10,500, but instead quotes $16,700. For claims adjusters, the median ratio was 43%. We stress that these results are medians. In half the pairs of cases, the difference between the 2 judgments was even larger. The executives to whom we reported the results of the noise audit were quick to realize that the sheer volume of noise presented an expensive problem. One senior executive estimated that the company's annual cost of noise and underwriting, counting both the loss of business from excessive quotes and the losses incurred on underpriced contracts, was in the hundreds of millions of dollars. No one could say precisely how much error or how much bias there was, because no one could know for sure the Goldilocks value for each case. But no one needed to see the bullseye to measure the scatter on the back of the target, and to realize that the variability was a problem. The data showed that the price a customer is asked to pay depends to an uncomfortable extent on the lottery that picks the employee who will deal with that transaction. To say the least, customers would not be pleased to hear that they were signed up for such a lottery without their consent. More generally, people who deal with organizations expect a system that reliably delivers consistent judgments. They do not expect system noise. Unwanted variability versus wanted diversity. A defining feature of system noise is that it is unwanted. And we should stress right here that variability in judgments is not always unwanted. Consider matters of preference or taste. If 10 film critics watch the same movie, if 10 wine tasters rate the same wine, or if 10 people read the same novel, we do not expect them to have the same opinion. Diversity of tastes is welcome and entirely expected. No one would want to live in a world in which everyone has exactly the same likes and dislikes. Well, almost no one. But diversity of tastes can help account for errors if a personal taste is mistaken for a professional judgment. If a film producer decides to go forward with an unusual project about, say, the rise and fall of the rotary phone, because she personally likes the script, she might have made a major mistake if no one else likes it. Variability in judgments is also expected and welcome in a competitive situation in which the best judgments will be rewarded. When several companies or several teams in the same organization compete to generate innovative solutions to the same customer problem, we don't want them to focus on the same approach. The same is true when multiple teams of researchers attack a scientific problem, such as the development of a vaccine. We very much want them to look at it from different angles. Even forecasters sometimes behave like competitive players. The analyst who correctly calls a recession that no one else has anticipated is sure to gain fame, whereas the one who never strays from the consensus remains obscure. In such settings, variability in ideas and judgments is again welcome, because variation is only the first step. In a second phase, the results of these judgments will be pitted against one another, and the best will triumph. In a market, as in nature, selection cannot work without variation. Matters of taste and competitive settings all pose interesting problems of judgment, but our focus is on judgments in which variability is undesirable. System noise is a problem of systems, which are organizations, not markets. When traders make different assessments of the value of a stock, some of them will make money and others will not. Disagreements make markets. But if one of those traders is randomly chosen to make that assessment on behalf of her firm, and if we find out that her colleagues in the same firm would produce very different assessments, then the firm faces system noise. And that is a problem. An elegant illustration of the issue arose when we presented our findings to the senior managers of an asset management firm, prompting them to run their own exploratory noise audit. They asked 42 experienced investors in the firm to estimate the fair value of a stock, the price at which the investors would be indifferent to buying or selling. The investors based their analysis on a one-page description of the business. The data included simplified profit and loss, balance sheet, and cash flow statements for the past 3 years, and projections for the next two. Median noise, measured in the same way as in the insurance company, was 41%. Such large differences among investors in the same firm, using the same valuation methods, cannot be good news. Wherever the person making a judgment is randomly selected from a pool of equally qualified individuals, as is the case in this asset management firm, in the criminal justice system, and in the insurance company discussed earlier, noise is a problem. System noise plagues many organizations. An assignment process that is effectively random often decides which doctor sees you in a hospital, which judge hears your case in a courtroom, which patent examiner reviews your application, which customer service representative hears your complaint, and so on. Unwanted variability in these judgments can cause serious problems, including a loss of money and rampant unfairness. A frequent misconception about unwanted variability in judgments is that it doesn't matter, because random errors supposedly cancel one another out. Certainly, positive and negative errors in a judgment about the same case will tend to cancel one another out, and we will discuss in detail how this property can be used to reduce noise. But noisy systems do not make multiple judgments of the same case. They make noisy judgments of different cases. If one insurance policy is overpriced and another is underpriced, pricing may on average look right, but the insurance company has made two costly errors. If two felons who both should be sentenced to 5 years in prison receive sentences of 3 years and 7 years, justice has not, on average, been done. In noisy systems, errors do not cancel out. They add up. The illusion of agreement. A large literature going back several decades has documented noise in professional judgment. Because we were aware of this literature, the results of the insurance company's noise audit did not surprise us. What did surprise us, however, was the reaction of the executives to whom we reported our findings. No one at the company had expected anything like the amount of noise we had observed. No one questioned the validity of the audit, and no one claimed that the observed amount of noise was acceptable. Yet the problem of noise and its large cost seemed like a new one for the organization. Noise was like a leak in the basement. It was tolerated not because it was thought acceptable, but because it had remained unnoticed. How could that be? How could professionals in the same role and in the same office differ so much from one another without becoming aware of it? How could executives fail to make this observation, which they understood to be a significant threat to the performance and reputation of their company? We came to see that the problem of system noise often goes unrecognized in organizations, and that the common inattention to noise is as interesting as its prevalence. The noise audit suggested that respected professionals, and the organizations that employ them, maintained an illusion of agreement, while in fact disagreeing in their daily professional judgments. To begin to understand how the illusion of agreement arises, put yourself in the shoes of an underwriter on a normal working day. You have more than 5 years of experience, you know that you are well regarded among your colleagues, and you respect and like them. You know you are good at your job. After thoroughly analyzing the complex risks faced by a financial firm, you conclude that a premium of $200,000 is appropriate. The problem is complex, but not much different from those you solve every day of the week. Now, imagine being told that your colleagues at the office have been given the same information and assessed the same risk. Could you believe that at least half of them have set a premium that is either higher than $255,000 or lower than $145,000? The thought is hard to accept. Indeed, we suspect that underwriters who heard about the noise audit and accepted its validity never truly believed that its conclusions applied to them personally. Most of us, most of the time, live with the unquestioned belief that the world looks as it does because that's the way it is. There is one small step from this belief to another. Other people view the world much the way I do. These beliefs, which have been called naive realism, are essential to the sense of a reality we share with other people. We rarely question these beliefs. We hold a single interpretation of the world around us at any one time, and we normally invest little effort in generating plausible alternatives to it. One interpretation is enough, and we experience it as true. We do not go through life imagining alternative ways of seeing what we see. In the case of professional judgments, the belief that others see the world much as we do is reinforced every day in multiple ways. First, we share with our colleagues a common language and set of rules about the considerations that should matter in our decisions. We also have the reassuring experience of agreeing with others on the absurdity of judgments that violate these rules. We view the occasional disagreements with colleagues as lapses of judgment on their part. We have little opportunity to notice that our agreed-on rules are vague, sufficient to eliminate some possibilities, but not to specify a shared positive response to a particular case. We can live comfortably with colleagues without ever noticing that they actually do not see the world as we do. One underwriter we interviewed described her experience in becoming a veteran in her department. "When I was new, I would discuss 75% of cases with my supervisor. After a few years, I didn't need to. I am now regarded as an expert. Over time, I became more and more confident in my judgment." Like many of us, this person had developed confidence in her judgment mainly by exercising it. The psychology of this process is well understood. Confidence is nurtured by the subjective experience of judgments that are made with increasing fluency and ease, in part because they resemble judgments made in similar cases in the past. Over time, as this underwriter learned to agree with her past self, her confidence in her judgments increased. She gave no indication that, after the initial apprenticeship phase, she had learned to agree with others, had checked to what extent she did agree with them, or had even tried to prevent her practices from drifting away from those of her colleagues. For the insurance company, the illusion of agreement was shattered only by the noise audit. How had the leaders of the company remained unaware of their noise problem? There are several possible answers here, but one that seems to play a large role in many settings is simply the discomfort of disagreement. Most organizations prefer consensus and harmony over dissent and conflict. The procedures in place often seem expressly designed to minimize the frequency of exposure to actual disagreements, and, when such disagreements happen, to explain them away. Nathan Kunzel, a professor of psychology at the University of Minnesota and a leading researcher on the prediction of performance, shared with us a story that illustrates this problem. Kunzel was helping a school's admissions office review its decision process. First, a person read an application file, rated it, and then handed it off with ratings to a second reader, who then also rated it. Kunzel suggested, for reasons that will become obvious throughout this book, that it would be preferable to mask the first reader's ratings so as not to influence the second reader. The school's reply, "We used to do that, but it resulted in so many disagreements that we switched to the current system." This school is not the only organization that considers conflict avoidance at least as important as making the right decision. Consider another mechanism that many companies resort to: postmortems of unfortunate judgments. As a learning mechanism, postmortems are useful. But if a mistake has truly been made, in the sense that a judgment strayed far from professional norms, discussing it will not be challenging. Experts will easily conclude that the judgment was way off the consensus. They might also write it off as a rare exception. Bad judgment is much easier to identify than good judgment. The calling out of egregious mistakes and the marginalization of bad colleagues will not help professionals become aware of how much they disagree when making broadly acceptable judgments. On the contrary, the easy consensus about bad judgments may even reinforce the illusion of agreement. The true lesson about the ubiquity of system noise will never be learned. We hope you are starting to share our view that system noise is a serious problem. Its existence is not a surprise. Noise is a consequence of the informal nature of judgment. However, as we will see throughout this book, the amount of noise observed when an organization takes a serious look almost always comes as a shock. Our conclusion is simple. Wherever there is judgment, there is noise. And more of it than you think. Speaking of system noise in the insurance company, we depend on the quality of professional judgments by underwriters, claims adjusters, and others. We assign each case to one expert, but we operate under the wrong assumption that another expert would produce a similar judgment. System noise is 5 times larger than we thought, or than we can tolerate. Without a noise audit, we would never have realized that. The noise audit shattered the illusion of agreement. System noise is a serious problem. It costs us hundreds of millions. Wherever there is judgment, there is noise, and more of it than we think. Chapter 3. Singular Decisions. The case studies we have discussed thus far involve judgments that are made repeatedly. What is the right sentence for someone convicted of theft? What is the right premium for a particular risk? While each case is in some sense unique, judgments like these are recurrent decisions. Doctors diagnosing patients, judges hearing parole cases, admissions officers reviewing applications, accountants preparing tax forms, these are all examples of recurrent decisions. Noise in recurrent decisions is demonstrated by a noise audit, such as those we introduced in the previous chapter. Unwanted variability is easy to define and measure when interchangeable professionals make decisions in similar cases. It seems much harder, or perhaps even impossible, to apply the idea of noise to a category of judgments that we call singular decisions. Consider, for instance, the crisis the world faced in 2014. In West Africa, numerous people were dying from Ebola. Because the world is interconnected, projections suggested that infections would rapidly spread all over the world and hit Europe and North America particularly hard. In the United States, there were insistent calls to shut down air travel from affected regions and to take aggressive steps to close the borders. The political pressure to move in that direction was intense, and prominent and well-informed people favored those steps. President Barack Obama was faced with one of the most difficult decisions of his presidency, one that he had not encountered before and never encountered again. He chose not to close any borders. Instead, he sent 3,000 people, health workers and soldiers, to West Africa. He led a diverse international coalition of nations that did not always work well together, using their resources and expertise to tackle the problem at its source. Singular versus recurrent. Decisions that are made only once, like the president's Ebola response, are singular because they are not made recurrently by the same individual or team. They lack a pre-packaged response, and they are marked by genuinely unique features. In dealing with Ebola, President Obama and his team had no real precedents on which to draw. Important political decisions are often good examples of singular decisions, as are the most fateful choices of military commanders. In the private realm, decisions you make when choosing a job, buying a house, or proposing marriage have the same characteristics. Even if this is not your first job, house, or marriage, and despite the fact that countless people have faced these decisions before, the decision feels unique to you. In business, heads of companies are often called on to make what seem like unique decisions to them. Whether to launch a potentially game-changing innovation, how much to close down during a pandemic, whether to open an office in a foreign country, or whether to capitulate to a government that seeks to regulate them. Arguably, there is a continuum, not a category difference, between singular and recurrent decisions. Underwriters may deal with some cases that strike them as very much out of the ordinary. Conversely, if you are buying a house for the 4th time in your life, you have probably started to think of home buying as a recurrent decision. But extreme examples clearly suggest that the difference is meaningful. Going to war is one thing. Going through annual budget reviews is another. Noise in singular decisions. Singular decisions have traditionally been treated as quite separate from the recurrent judgments that interchangeable employees routinely make in large organizations. While social scientists have dealt with recurrent decisions, high-stakes singular decisions have been the province of historians and management gurus. The approaches to the two types of decisions have been quite different. Analyses of recurrent decisions have often taken a statistical bent, with social scientists assessing many similar decisions to discern patterns, identify regularities, and measure accuracy. In contrast, discussions of singular decisions typically adopt a causal view. They are conducted in hindsight and are focused on identifying the causes of what happened. Historical analyses, like case studies of management successes and failures, aim to understand how an essentially unique judgment was made. The nature of singular decisions raises an important question for the study of noise. We have defined noise as undesirable variability in judgments of the same problem. Since singular problems are never exactly repeated, this definition does not apply to them. After all, history is only run once. You will never be able to compare Obama's decision to send health workers and soldiers to West Africa in 2014 with the decisions other American presidents made about how to handle that particular problem at that particular time, though you can speculate. You may agree to compare your decision to marry that special someone with the decisions of other people like you, but that comparison will not be as relevant to you as the one we made between the quotes of underwriters on the same case. You and your spouse are unique. There is no direct way to observe the presence of noise in singular decisions. Yet singular decisions are not free from the factors that produce noise in recurrent decisions. At the shooting range, the shooters on Team C, the noisy team, may be adjusting the gun sight on their rifle in different directions, or their hands may just be unsteady. If we observed only the first shooter on the team, we would have no idea how noisy the team is, but the sources of noise would still be there. Similarly, when you make a singular decision, you have to imagine that another decision maker, even one just as competent as you and sharing the same goals and values, would not reach the same conclusion from the same facts. And as the decision maker, you should recognize that you might have made a different decision if some irrelevant aspects of the situation or of the decision-making process had been different. In other words, we cannot measure noise in a singular decision. But if we think counterfactually, we know for sure that noise is there. Just as the shooter's unsteady hand implies that a single shot could have landed somewhere else, noise in the decision-makers and in the decision-making process implies that the singular decision could have been different. Consider all the factors that affect a singular decision. If the experts in charge of analyzing the Ebola threat and preparing response plans had been different people, with different backgrounds and life experiences, would their proposals to President Obama have been the same? If the same facts had been presented in a slightly different manner, would the conversation have unfolded the same way? If the key players had been in a different mood or had been meeting during a snowstorm, would the final decision have been identical? Seen in this light, the singular decision does not seem so determined. Depending on many factors that we are not even aware of, the decision could plausibly have been different. For another exercise in counterfactual thinking, consider how different countries and regions responded to the COVID-19 crisis. Even when the virus hit them roughly at the same time and in a similar manner, there were wide differences in responses. This variation provides clear evidence of noise in different countries' decision-making. But what if the epidemic had struck a single country? In that case, we wouldn't have observed any variability. But our inability to observe variability would not make the decision less noisy. Controlling noise in singular decisions. This theoretical discussion matters. If singular decisions are just as noisy as recurrent ones, then the strategies that reduce noise in recurrent decisions should also improve the quality of singular decisions. This is a more counterintuitive prescription than it seems. When you have a one-of-a-kind decision to make, your instinct is probably to treat it as, well, one-of-a-kind. Some even claim that the rules of probabilistic thinking are entirely irrelevant to singular decisions made under uncertainty, and that such decisions call for a radically different approach. Our observations here suggest the opposite advice. From the perspective of noise reduction, a singular decision is a recurrent decision that happens only once. Whether you make a decision only once or 100 times, your goal should be to make it in a way that reduces both bias and noise. And practices that reduce error should be just as effective in your one-of-a-kind decisions as in your repeated ones. Speaking of singular decisions, the way you approach this unusual opportunity exposes you to noise. Remember, a singular decision is a recurrent decision that is made only once. The personal experiences that made you who you are not truly relevant to this decision. Part 2. Your mind is a measuring instrument. Measurement in everyday life, as in science, is the act of using an instrument to assign a value on a scale to an object or event. You measure the length of a carpet in inches, using a tape measure. You measure the temperature in degrees Fahrenheit or Celsius by consulting a thermometer. The act of making a judgment is similar. When judges determine the appropriate prison term for a crime, they assign a value on a scale. So do underwriters when they set a dollar value to ensure a risk, or doctors when they make a diagnosis. The scale need not be numerical. Guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, advanced melanoma, and surgery is recommended are judgments too. Judgment can therefore be described as measurement in which the instrument is a human mind. Implicit in the notion of measurement is the goal of accuracy, to approach truth and minimize error. The goal of judgment is not to impress, not to take a stand, not to persuade. It is important to note that the concept of judgment as we use it here is borrowed from the technical psychological literature, and that it is a much narrower concept than the same word has in everyday language. Judgment is not a synonym for thinking, and making accurate judgments is not a synonym for having good judgment. As we define it, a judgment is a conclusion that can be summarized in a word or phrase. If an intelligence analyst writes a long report leading to the conclusion that a regime is unstable, only the conclusion is a judgment. Judgment, like measurement, refers both to the mental activity of making a judgment and to its product. And we will sometimes use judge as a technical term to describe people who make judgments, even when they have nothing to do with the judiciary. Although accuracy is the goal, perfection in achieving this goal is never achieved even in scientific measurement, much less in judgment. There is always some error, some of which is bias and some of which is noise. To experience how noise and bias contribute to error, we invite you to play a game that will take you less than 1 minute. If you have a smartphone with a stopwatch, it probably has a lap function, which enables you to measure consecutive time intervals without stopping the stopwatch or even looking at the display. Your goal is to produce 5 consecutive laps of exactly 10 seconds without looking at the phone. You may want to observe a 10-second interval a few times before you begin. Feel free to pause the book as needed. Now look at the lap durations recorded on your phone. The phone itself was not free from noise, but there was very little of it. You will see that the laps are not all exactly 10 seconds, and that they vary over a substantial range. You tried to reproduce the same timing exactly, but you were unable to do so. The variability you could not control is an instance of noise. This finding is hardly surprising because noise is universal in physiology and psychology. Variability across individuals is a biological given. No two peas in a pod are truly identical. Within the same person, there is variability too. Your heartbeat is not exactly regular. You cannot repeat the same gesture with perfect precision. And when you have your hearing examined by an audiologist, there will be some sounds so soft you never hear them, and others so loud you always do. But there will also be some sounds that you will sometimes hear and sometimes miss. Now look at the 5 numbers on your phone. Do you see a pattern? For instance, are all 5 laps shorter than 10 seconds, a pattern suggesting that your internal clock is running fast? In this simple task, the bias is the difference, positive or negative, between the mean of your laps and 10 seconds. Noise constitutes the variability of your results, analogous to the scatter of shots we saw earlier. In statistics, the most common measure of variability is standard deviation, and we will use it to measure noise in judgments. We can think of most judgments, specifically predictive judgments, as similar to the measurements you just made. When we make a prediction, we attempt to come close to a true value. An economic forecaster aims to be as close as possible to the true value of the growth in next year's gross domestic product. A doctor aims to make the correct diagnosis. Note that the term prediction, in the technical sense used in this book, does not imply predicting the future. For our purposes, the diagnosis of an existing medical condition is a prediction. We will rely extensively on the analogy between judgment and measurement because it helps explain the role of noise in